about him. The show's all about it. Melbourne wants to shout it. We're gonna tell you all about it. Matthew Bronson.
Hello, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson on KUPR 99.9 on the FM dial here in the high desert of Placidas, New Mexico. Today on Conversations, we're going to be speaking to, I don't want to say one of the original Placidans, but someone who's been here for over 30 years, and that is Alan Firestone. So welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Matthew.
So to some people, you are known as Dr. Firestone. To some people, you are known as the violinist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the team member in a soccer league.
Right.
Or as a former captain in the Navy.
That's true. Navy Reserves.
It was always Navy Reserves.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, at some point in the past, your parents ended up in Ohio.
Both my parents were born in Youngstown, Ohio.
Okay.
And grew up there. My father bounced back and forth to the area around Pittsburgh in the mining and steelworking areas. And then settled back in Ohio, I guess, in his late teens. And had stayed there until he retired.
And it was a happy childhood.
What I remember of it, yeah, it was fun. We had access to woods and went pretty much everywhere on bicycle or hitchhiking.
Without a helmet?
Oh, yeah, no helmets.
And somehow you seem to have survived quite well?
For the most part.
Did you make your children wear helmets when they were riding bicycles?
No, I don't think they had helmets. That was 38 years ago for Ethan. He was riding around. Josh, a little bit later than that. But the bicycle helmets really didn't come in until after they had pretty much done riding. Ethan wears was now when he goes out and does some mountain biking, but that's about it.
And they also played on the steel jungle gyms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember any of that being a problem.
No, for the most part, they didn't break anything.
No. So back to the Firestone clan, Russian, Austrian, Hungarian roots.
Yes.
And so it was grandpa that came to America?
Grandfather on both sides of the family were immigrants. And my mother's father said he was from Russia, but we suspect it was probably Lithuania. And my father's father came in from someplace in the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Why would someone at that time in history, if you know, why he wanted to disguise that he was from Lithuania?
I'm not sure. I think part of it may have been that Lithuania was intermittently part of Russia, and probably during the time period when he emigrated, it was to avoid being drafted into the Russian army.
That would have been for World War I?
No, it was just in general that they got drafted in the army, and for Jews in Russia, the draft could be 30 years.
And probably not a terribly pleasant experience.
No.
Couldn't really tell the difference between the military and the gulag? Or
not much different.
So they left for religious reasons?
Not so much for religious reasons as just to avoid being conscripted and stuck in for 30 years and to seek a better life.
Right. I wonder how people knew, without the internet, that Everybody from all over the planet wanted to come to the United States. The United States wasn't all that old at that point, yet this was the place to be.
Well, it was well over 100 years. Well, it was about 100 years old at the time they came over, maybe 120 years old. And they just knew that it was a land where there was some opportunity. Many of the people who came over had family who had been over, and
okay.
And either had written back or had gone back to bring their wife over or to find a spouse and bring her over.
Right.
And so there was already a pretty good network. Communication was very slow, but it did get there.
Well, you would have to, you know, doing some of the rough math, just to get yourself together enough to be able to book passage to schedule the ship. They don't leave every day at noon. Then however long the voyage was, get settled, communicate back one or two times. They didn't have priority mail. It could have been a couple of years, you know?
Yeah, at least that.
And how many of the people do you think immigrated to escape the law? Maybe that's why America was so colorful.
Well, there was some of that. And also there were, particularly out of England and Ireland, lawbreakers could be transported and put into an indentured servitude in the colonies. And so that accounts for some of the people that came over. Certainly, some of the people who left Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire were probably running away from legal problems, possibly debt.
Right.
There were, during the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were also religious pogroms that were going on, particularly in Russia and Poland, people left for those reasons, too.
Well, two things kind of stick out in my mind. The fact that someone would say, oh, no, I'm you know, Hungarian, I'm not Lithuanian. It reminds me of, like, the first couple times we traveled overseas before 9/11, but still we weren't sure how people were going to receive Americans. So, oh, no, we're Canadian. And I always think of the Blues Brothers with the Coneheads. Oh, no, we're from Canada.
Yeah. There are times when you get tempted to say that. On the other hand, if you say it in the language of the country you're in, or if you just say, "No, I'm American," in the language,
right.
Then people are a lot more accepting.
Yes, we have found that out. There's probably only three basic phrases that I know, but I try to learn it in almost every language. If we're going to that country, or if we happen to take a cruise, you have a lot of Eastern European, Lithuanians, Bulgarians, Romanians. And if you could just say hello, man, your cabin is beautiful every time you come back from dinner. It's just nice to be nice to people.
Oh, yeah.
So you didn't go into the steel mill.
Actually, I did. I worked summers in the steel mill. The summer after I graduated from Oberlin and the summer between first and second year of medical school, I worked in the steel mill.
Did you go to Oberlin because you were an Ohio resident?
I got interested in Oberlin because one of my friends from when we were growing up, he lived up the block and used to show up at our house for dinner every day after he had eaten dinner at his house. Was at Oberlin, and I knew the reputation of the school, and I think the social awareness of the school was also interesting. I applied there in March of my junior year with the intent of going there that fall, and they said, well, we've already made up our class for next year, and you know, you look like a good candidate. Why don't you apply for the following year? And then I got home, and the coach, or maybe somebody from admissions, called me and said, "How come you didn't tell us you were a diver?" And so I went back and I talked to the coach, and they said, "Well, if your high school graduates you, then we'll go ahead and take you this fall." And so I went back to the high school and I said, "They said they'll take me, so you might as well graduate me."
You earlier.
Yeah, so I got out.
That was unusual back then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And this was based upon being a scuba diver.
No, springboard diving.
Oh, springboard. I was going, what an odd thing. Well, I guess springboard diving is not all that more odd than being admitted because of a scuba diving.
Well, it's a competitive sport, so it's part of the swim team. I had learned essentially 1 meter platform diving, because when I started diving, it was before they had the Duraflex boards.
Right.
And at 68 pounds, I couldn't bend the board. And so,
you have to put lid weights in your pockets, or
no, that didn't work either. But so basically, I learned 1 meter platform diving.
Yeah, 68's not a lot.
No.
Did you ever have a period? Not to go way off path, but that tends to be my pattern. Were you ever heavy, or at least in your mind heavy?
No.
And so this is genetic.
It's pretty much genetic, but that was 4'3" and 68 pounds.
Okay.
And diving number one varsity.
I remember in school always running across these people, guys, who back when people thought a Big Mac was an okay meal, he could eat a couple of those and a couple of things of fries and a milkshake, and he was slight of frame like you. It's like, this, there is no God. That was the definitive proof.
Well, I didn't eat a lot when I was young, until I turned about 14 or 15, and then pretty much ate what I wanted.
The sports didn't make you carb hungry or whatever?
No, not especially. Yeah.
We used to go out to dinner when we were living on the East Coast with some friends who were very close with your granddaughter, and she was basketball, soccer, all of that. And we used to go to the student union over at Florida Institute of Technology. They had a wonderful buffet, one price, whatever, decent food, cooked it all there. She would chow down on so much pasta that she, of course, was skinny.
Yeah, but she burned it off.
Right. But you never had those big appetites?
Not so much. I'll carbohydrate load now before a soccer game. So if I've had pasta earlier in the week, you know, save about half of it and have that for breakfast on the morning of the game.
All right. So we know in young Dr. Firestone's life, you were a competitive diver. Now, I loved to swim growing up. I got my lifesaver, you know, very young. I think we did a few swim meets, but it was always, you know, the regular crawl or breaststroke or whatever. I don't remember, maybe I was too young, but maybe none of us could have bent the board, but it was always swimming. And you must have started out as a swimmer.
No, I started out as a gymnast. I could swim about far enough to get from where I pushed off the bottom of the pool back to the side of the pool, and that was about it.
But that's not stamina. That's not physical.
No. But basically, I just, the only time I slowed down pretty much ever was when I would sit and read, and I could read for 8 or 10 hours at a time.
Right.
But for the most part, if I wasn't reading, I was up moving.
That was before they knew about ADD, or you just, you're just,
yeah,
an active
I don't think they knew about it at that time. I might have had a very little bit, but it's difficult to say ADD when you have somebody who can sit and focus on something for 6 or 8 or 10 hours.
Well, that's true.
And
you're just being a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, so we're talking about around 1960. Not a lot of television. I mean,
three channels, and it went off the air at about 11 o'clock at night.
And yet, Howdy Doody and Gene Autry and all that stuff. How did you know that you wanted to dive?
Well, it started out with gymnastics. And
Who would have heard of gymnastics in 1960?
Oh, we all had.
Really?
You know, oh, sure.
Okay.
I can remember actually going to see some of the Japanese Olympic team and driving over to Pittsburgh to watch them. So, no, we knew about gymnastics. And going down to the YMCA and spending time doing gymnastics, and then we would also go ahead and go to the swimming pool. And so I got started just diving a little bit, and then the YMCA had a swim team, and our coach, Lefty Law, was an old diver.
Okay.
And so he got us started doing a few more things, and was doing pretty well in some of the local AAU meets.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of wanting more challenge in high school and wanting to go ahead and continue with the diving, I wound up going away to school to a prep school in New England for 3 years and dove there. And then seeing as how it helped me get into college a year early, went ahead and dove at Oberlin for 4 years.
So many questions come to mind. Your coach, Lefty Law, sounds more like he was either a former pugilist, you know, a boxer, or a member of the Ohio mob. That was his, I guess, Christian name, or?
No. I don't know what his Christian name was. We always just called him Lefty.
Okay.
And he was sort of a short, dumpy guy. And but
oh, he wasn't even athletic?
Not at that point. He was about, probably in his 50s when I first met him.
So he was old.
He was old. Compared to you. Yeah. And, but he still was able to go ahead and teach you how to do a dive without having to be able to do it himself. He could walk you through the steps that you needed.
Right.
And was really a great coach. And he actually coached some of the guys from that YMCA swim team, went on to be junior Olympians. One of them, Ross Wales, took third in the, I think it was 100-meter freestyle at the Mexico City Olympics. Basically he was a very good coach and
right.
able to get a lot out of the team.
Well, I mean, I get your point. I'm not a huge football or, you know, that kind of televised sport. Somehow I got cursed with liking cricket, but I might have been living on a British island.
I'll have to get you to explain it to me sometime.
No one understands it. That's half of the intrigue. But, you know, you look at these coaches, and they're not, they couldn't, like, substitute for one of the players. So I guess Lefty, you know, gets a pass.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but the gymnast part, first of all, it wasn't that predominantly young ladies, little girls?
Oh, no.
No?
No. Parallel bars, high bar.
Rings.
Rings. Some floor exercise stuff.
Okay.
Again, we had people who were really in Ohio, might be champions in Ohio.
Right.
And then went on in college to progress. Mm-hmm. I learned pretty quickly that it hurt a lot less to fall or to land wrong when you were diving than it did to land wrong when you were coming off the rings.
Oh, sure.
or the high bar.
And that's probably my lack of exposure, because when you said gymnast, there's only one of the exercises or parts of gymnastics that I thought of, and that was that big beam, the triple beam or whatever, and the super skinny girl doing the flips and all that and the dismount, and then I had forgotten about. There's a lot of other stuff in gymnastics.
The pommel horse, vaulting, rings, high bar, parallel bars, and the floor exercises.
Shot put and javelin are track?
Track, yeah.
Because there's so much running involved in javelin.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you do gymnastics, is it like being in an orchestra or going getting a music degree, you have to learn to play each instrument. Did you have to do each of the exercises?
Did a little bit of each of the exercises, but focused more on rings and the floor exercise. I never got to the point where a lot of there's a big contingent of gymnasts out of Rio Rancho, Gold Cup Gymnastics, and they're really pretty focused and spend huge amounts of time practicing, and I never really got to that point. I had switched over to diving long before I got to that point.
Did you ever, in the floor exercises, like jump up on that triple beam and do flips or whatever?
No.
That would scare me to death. It looks wide from a distance, but up close, it's not very big. You know, and you notice they never put their whole foot on it. It's always kind of curling over it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I'm glad you had the common sense to avoid that. But gymnastics, as well as competitive diving, I mean, they're both competitive, but they're individual.
Very individual.
It's not. Yeah. And I can't say, well, you don't want to do team sports because you play soccer.
Yeah.
And
but
so
that was later.
Soccer was later. Hey, it's still Matthew Bronson. I want to let you know that you are still listening to KUPR 99.9 plus Cedis, New Mexico, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson. If you happen to be more visual than audio, most of our interviews are also available in video format on abqlive.tv. So choose your poison. And now back to Conversations with Dr. Alan Firestone. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, you always got to take these commercial breaks, I guess, you know, even though we're on a LPFM. And although people can contribute, they just can't advertise.
Okay. And there are places to contribute, like at the Merck. After you check out, you can put your spare change in the bottle, and every little bit helps.
Yes. And it is surprising how expensive it is to run an operation like this. I mean, a fraction of what it was 20 years ago, but still... Even though, you know, everyone is volunteered, there's still electricity and those executive board meetings in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
They just add up. But everybody knows I was kidding, right? So you were very athletic. Actually, would you have considered yourself athletic? Because competitive diving and gymnast and... you know, that type, and music.
I would say I was physically active. I didn't necessarily think of myself as being one of the jocks.
And how did they think of you?
I think they thought I was one of them.
Okay, well that it's safer.
Yeah. The interesting thing was that both in high school and college, and you know, obviously now the I wasn't really defined by one particular clique or one particular part of my life, so that I could be part of the jocks, I could be part of the nerds, I could be part of the politically active people. Never really in the center of stuff, frequently on the fringes, but my friends came from all the different groups.
And there was never a peer group pressure of... Oh, you know, we're going off to do this. Why do you want to go do that with those people?
No, not with the guys that I was hanging out with.
That sounds very Ohio.
It's
they're right
Ohio.
Below Canada on being polite.
It was Ohio, but it was also Los Angeles and also Massachusetts, and certainly out here. There's a tremendous amount of tolerance and a tremendous amount of mixing of all the different groups out here.
Even at the high school level?
I think for the most part, even at the high school level.
So, all right, so even though you had a more traditional suburban education and then eventually private school for high school, you were still... happy with the education your children were getting, at least initially, here in beautiful New Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that particularly Placidus Elementary School has always been a very, very good school.
So music was the third leg of the stool?
Well, maybe the third or fourth or fifth.
Well, third at this point. We'll get to the fourth.
Well, I grew up in a house where there wasn't a lot of music on all the time, but when there was, it was classical or jazz. And I remember as a young kid going to the symphony either with my parents or frequently the school would go to the Youngstown Symphony. And so we had exposure that way. And then also school band at the high school I went to, or the grade school I went to, we did a lot of the light classical stuff, Poet and Peasant Overture and Fingal's Cave. We also had a marching band. I played E-flat clarinet, which is the little squeaky clarinet. But we had strings, violin, cello, we had horns, we had timpani.
How did you decide on the E-flat clarinet? Or the band director said, you're playing the E-flat clarinet?
I have no idea. My brother played clarinet and saxophone, so I picked up woodwinds. And then when I was about 13, I quit doing band. And my brother was really heavily into music and classical music, and actually majored in music when he went to George Washington University and became an orchestra manager. So because he liked classical music, I couldn't like classical music. So I was interested in easy listening music. There was a station that played easy listening music, but then he went and was a nighttime DJ on the easy listening music station. So I couldn't like that. So I gravitated toward jazz as far as listening. And
you weren't allowed to like anything he liked?
Well, there was a little competition.
Oh. But he liked girls. That was okay.
Yeah, that was okay.
Okay.
Yeah, except that didn't happen until later.
Okay.
But the Oberlin had WOBC, which was a low power FM and closed circuit carrier current AM station, which meant that there was no antenna for the AM. It was plugged into the electrical system in the college, and so if you plugged in a radio into the electrical system, then you could pick it up. And so very early on, a couple of friends and I started doing a jazz show, Walk on the Wild Side. And, of course, you know, start off with Jimmy Smith playing Walk on the Wild Side.
Right.
And
this was a true terrestrial radio station, like over 1,000 watts?
Oh, well, I don't think so.
Okay.
It might make it outside, a little bit outside the city limits of Oberlin, but not far.
Did they pay you? Or?
Oh, no.
Did you have to pay them?
No. It was all volunteer, right? And
with sponsors? Did you say go down to Lucky's Fried Chicken?
Absolutely not.
So who funded this?
The college. It was just a college activity. And some of the guys who worked in the radio station went on to become quite prominent. Robert Krulwich was... He and John Field did the Krulwich Field Report, so political commentary every week. And he went on to be one of the broadcasters for All Things Considered. And
great show.
And also, I can't think of the name of the other show he does, but he's still very active in public radio. And we also had people who were involved in sports radio and all kinds of things like that. Well, somebody was... I think head of or second in command of NPR, Ted Guest.
Mm-hmm.
So
there was no John Stewart type person, or
well, I think that was Krulwich and Field.
Okay,
I was interested in jazz straight through. Well, I still am, but when I was in medical school in my second year, a friend of mine, Dan Tanberg. It was probably the reason we wound up in New Mexico, but he had a harpsichord that he had built, and
of course, the wasn't everyone
was playing harpsichord, and got me started listening to the Bach Brandenburg concertos, and then a little bit of Beethoven, and started listening to a little bit more and a little bit more, and then we bought some of the Time Life series, all the Beethoven and great men of music, and
sure,
and the great eras of music,
and you sometimes know, you could get it you know, once a week down at the AMP. Right next to your Funkin' Wagnalls encyclopedia.
Well, not quite like that. What they did is that once a month they sent it out, and you could send it back if you didn't like it. But
I remember those record clubs.
Well, pretty soon I had a pretty good knowledge of a lot of different times of music. And then when we came out here in 76, the first June we were out here in 77, went to the June Music Festival, which was... at that time, just 3 weekends in June with 2 concerts per weekend, and they would have a resident string quartet, initially the Fine Arts Quartet, and after that, the Guarneri came for many years. But we happened to go hear the Fine Arts Quartet doing, and one of the pieces they played was Death and the Maiden. And I listened to that, and I said, I want to be able to do that. And so that percolated for a few months.
Right.
And... during which time I picked up recorder and was playing recorder a little bit. But in January of 1978, right before Josh was born, I went down to Robertson's and rented a violin. You could rent to own, so you could the payments, the rental would go toward purchase.
Right.
And I took it to a friend of mine who at that time was living in a school bus back by Tuapa. And Ron was a concert pianist from Chicago who'd sort of burned out and wound up out here living in his school bus with his dancer wife. And
it worked for the Partridge Family.
And would occasionally go ahead and put on these incredible classical performances.
With dancing?
No. Okay. Ron, you know, I said, "What do you do with this thing? How do you play it?" And he said, "Go."
This
get
is
a teacher.
After you had leased it.
Yeah, he said, "Go get a teacher," because I had no idea about tightening the hair on the bow or how to tune it or rosining the bow, anything. So went and found a found a teacher, and at that time she was 9 months and a week pregnant. And I showed up and said, "Okay, show me how to do this thing." And she said, "Go see Lois." Okay. So her neighbor, Lois Blackburn, was teaching in the Albuquerque Public Schools, teaching strings. And Lois is a cellist, and she had been had played cello with the New Mexico Symphony back before it was even the New Mexico Symphony. And so for several years I took from Lois and had a blast and really enjoyed it.
And did you already know basic music at that point from
your
band?
I could read music.
But the E-flat clarinet is not in the key of C.
It doesn't matter. You still read the music and you know put your fingers in
it's
the
like
right
place. It's
like
learning a different language when you go from different...
The woodwinds, I forget whether it's transcribing or non-transcribing, but what happens is if you see... a note fingered, so that if you read a C on the score and play that with the fingering, it's going to come out sounding different than the same note played on one of the, let's say, a B flat clarinet.
Right.
So what happens is when they write the music for the transcribing, transposing instruments, they will go ahead and it'll look like it's in a different key signature than, for example, a flute that's in C.
Right.
When you play it with the fingerings that are proposed for each of the instruments, it works out. So you can switch between an E-flat clarinet and a B-flat clarinet and without having to
rewrite the whole score.
Well, without having to go ahead and change in your mind how you, how your fingers go on a given note.
Right.
So there was no real problem with that. You know, reading music was reading music.
But playing a wind instrument, which, unless you're really, really good, you're playing one note at a time.
Yeah.
You know from your jazz world, sometimes they manage to get a couple in there.
Or a couple of instruments at a time, right, if you're Roland Kirk.
But when you move to a string instrument, all of a sudden, kind of like piano, chords become an issue. And where did you get that training from, not to get too down in the dirt, but, you know, an augmented seventh versus, you know, a major?
Okay, violins have no clue about chord structure. If a double stop is written, then you play the two notes that are written.
Right.
If a quadruple stop is written, you play the four notes that are down there, and you don't think about what chord that makes. Unlike piano, where you really are thinking in terms of chords, or guitar in terms of chords, with violin, you don't start out thinking in terms of that. You just try and play the notes that are showing on the score.
So, probably way too specific, but you went and leased the instrument, knowing, maybe not even having been close to violin before.
No strings.
And then you go, what do I do with it? Which seems like a major leap of faith to me for a trained scientist. So your teacher tuned it, tightened the bow.
Showed me how to tune it.
Here's the frog. And do you remember the first time that bow went across those strings?
Oh, yeah. It sounds pretty terrible. That's why they call it starting from scratch.
Yeah, good thing.
But
so how long before you could stand to listen to yourself practice?
That came actually fairly quickly. And one of the things that I would do is just go outside in the garage and do scales, or go out on the porch outside and do scales, mm-hmm, slowly. You gradually learn where to put your fingers to get the right sound. And the thing is, I can hear the scale. I can hear the intervals so that you adjust your fingers. And so really pretty quickly I got to where I could play simple things and could certainly read a lot more than what I could play. And there was an article in one of the free physician magazines, it was an article about the amateur chamber music players.
Okay.
And the amateur chamber music players are a worldwide organization of amateur chamber musicians. And they have some criteria where you rate yourself, and they publish a directory that has all of their members, including where they live, phone numbers, email. Now they have email. And what instruments they play, what instruments they have extra, whether they're willing to play on, whether they're willing to organize playing sessions.
Right.
And so you can actually go places and show up and say, hey, you want to play?
It reminds me of a website, excuse me, used to be in Central Florida, where I was living, for musicians that would say, here's our gig, we're going to be there Saturday, come see us, or band needs bass player. So yeah. It sounds similar to that.
It works. Anyway, so somebody contacted me, and I had been listening to a lot more chamber music and had gotten a few pieces, some Mozart, some early Beethoven, to begin to look at, but somebody called me and said, hey, you want to play? And so started playing string quartets with Peter Stern in Corrales. And after a while, he said, why don't you come on up to camp? And chamber music camp in Colorado. And it took about 3 or 4 years before he finally convinced me to go up there. And 60, 70, 80 people all playing, almost all of them are strings, and in various groups, string quartets, string trios, piano quartets, mm-hmm. piano trios, piano quintets.
How long was camp?
4 days.
Okay. So that's doable if you're a career person.
Yeah.
Two of them are the weekend.
Yeah. Okay. And the structure was three assigned sessions a day and three free sessions a day, so potentially 6 or 8 hours of playing music a day. And being in a situation where the skill levels varied from not very good up to professional, and where you would be forced to play more and more and more of the literature. At that, when I first started, a lot of it I didn't know, and that meant learning how to sight read,
right,
and how not to get lost, and so really excellent.
Or how to find your place once lost.
Oh yeah, usually takes there's a little chorus of Amazing Grace.
Mm-hmm.
I once was lost, but now I'm found. But you learn a lot. And you make good friends, people to play with all over the country. And
any instruction?
No.
Other than if someone is obviously better in one of your sessions, they'll say, hey, try it this way?
They may do that a little bit. But for the most part, if you had a really weak player in with a good group, the weak player would get better. And the good group would sort of go, okay, we're paying our dues, and it just worked out.
It's funny that you say that because I was just thinking about rekindling my chess career, which is very amateurish, and a lot of people don't like to play because they're going to lose, and when you're learning, you have to lose.
Yeah,
and I've always sought out people that will beat me because I learn so much more from getting my butt kicked than to being able to cream somebody. What's the satisfaction in being able to just beat somebody?
Yeah. On the other hand, there's a lot of satisfaction in playing against somebody with a skill level that's a little bit better than you or equal to you, because when you get really good, then the level of play actually goes up because of the skill level of the person that you're playing against or playing with.
But perhaps if I had gotten to that level, I always, I kind of picked up violin not quite the same way you did. I actually looked into it before I leased it. But my violin teacher in Florida, I guess I started about 4 years ago as part of a physical therapy recovery. And she was a great teacher. Used to be with Atlanta. She was a chamber mistress, which that name didn't sound right to me. But
the concert mistress?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So that's rough work, but somebody got to do it. But her kids were very musical, and they had a super math engineer father, so they homeschooled the whole deal. But even when I met her, the youngest was maybe in second grade, and he was already rated chess player. And it's interesting because we were talking about raising kids or whatever, and she kind of had the opposite dilemma, being very keen on the education and the music. They, took piano, and as they got older, she and her husband said, we need to expose them to sports. And my experience was that if you raise your kids in a sports household, you don't care about the chess club. And if you raise intellectual children, you don't care about t-ball. And so I always I just thought that was a very nice, that was good parenting, I guess what I'm trying to say. I was impressed with their decision to do that.
I think the thing is that one of the mottos of the YMCA was mens sana in corpore sana, so sound mind and sound body, healthy mind and healthy body, so that they recognize the connection. And I think the thing is that if you are an intellectual, if you love the arts, if you are a musician, you still need to get out and do things that will make your body feel good and feel healthy. And so if it's only walking or hiking or jogging or bicycling, that's important. If you like to go ahead and take your body and crash it into somebody bigger than you, playing soccer is fine.
That seems. What about rugby? Then that's really dangerous.
Yeah, it can be. I think the thing is that you find a level of activity that you're comfortable with, which hopefully won't injure you for other things that you want to do. So,
well, here we are, about 45 minutes into our conversation with Alan Firestone, to find that we're only about halfway done. So we've decided to turn this into a two-part conversation, and this will conclude part one. And please stay tuned for the next episode of Conversation with Matthew Bronson, where we conclude our conversation with Alan Firestone. Thank you.